This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. With a month to go before this week's deadline, 7% of all Americans signing up for health insurance nationwide were in Florida. This week marked the end of the enrollment period for individuals to get health insurance and avoid the possibility of facing a tax for not getting covered. According to the White House, 7.1 million people enrolled before Monday's deadline. In Florida, according to the Health and Human Services Administration, Miami-Dade County was the second most enrolled county in the nation through the middle of last month. But Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio on Fox News dismissed the enrollment statistics.
The bottom line is they have disrupted the entire healthcare marketplace for all Americans, and all they have to show for it is a small, minuscule dent in the number of people that are uninsured that are now insured.
Well, did you sign up at healthcare.gov over the past several months? What are you paying? What's your coverage? Are you happy with it? Have you used it? Are you going without healthcare insurance and going to be paying the tax? Share your story with us today on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-WLRN. Call in at 800-743-9576. Email us your story at thefloridaroundup@wlrn.org. thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. Send us a tweet using the handle @WLRN or the live blog right now at WLRN.org. Michael Mayo, a columnist with the Sun Sentinel, is along with us, and Tristram Corton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Both of you, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Mike, do we know who signed up for coverage in Florida?
A lot of people who didn't have insurance before.
Do we know that, though, for a fact, that they didn't have insurance?
Okay. I know that some people actually had the predecessor that was no longer offered. If you couldn't get covered by a private insurance company, the federal government for the past few years had what was known as like this uninsured fund. They offered kind of stopgap insurance. Mm-hmm. But that ended, and now some of those people have signed up for healthcare.gov. But what we do know is this. I mean, what Marco Rubio and the Republicans are saying is they're trying to diminish what good has come of this, because obviously they're using this as political fuel for their fire in the midterm elections. And for all, I mean, there was a host of problems with the sign-up, the enrollment, the website, all that. There's a host of problems with the actual implementation, mm-hmm. and also now, you know, costs are not going down. That's the bottom line. They could use all that for their political purposes, fine. But to kind of diminish the impact and saying that 7 million people who didn't have insurance or, you know, now have insurance, and to call that a minuscule dent, I think that comes off as pretty callous.
Well, the minuscule dent comes, Tristram, because more than 40 million Americans didn't have insurance prior to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Of the 7.1 million the White House claims to have signed up and enrolled, we don't know how many of those came from the pool of uninsured prior to this enrollment period.
Right. I was reading in the Los Angeles Times at the, and then I went and looked at the report itself, but the Urban Institute did, you know, a preliminary estimate and determined that since the enrollment period, comparing numbers on healthcare surveys and whatnot, since the enrollment period, 5 million people who were previously uninsured are now insured. Mm-hmm. Now, whether, you know, these numbers are still squishy, right? It's very early in all of this. But, you know, this is big for Florida because we had the highest rate of uninsured, right, in the country. And we're a state without a lot of other social safety nets.
It was big for Florida. 440,000 Floridians, Mike Mayo from the Sun Sentinel, had signed up through healthcare.gov through March 1st. So still another month to come. We haven't gotten those statistics yet. The Fed goal was under 400,000. So it sounds like Florida is a success. Some would argue a raging success.
Yeah, obviously there's a demand for it. And just think of what the number would have been if the website worked, or if Florida state officials actually set up our own website, you know, our own health exchange site like so many states did, such as California and New York. Look, the bottom line is this. A complex healthcare insurance system is still complicated and complex and costly. We have, you know, higher deductibles in some cases for people who signed up. We still don't know, even if these people who now have signed up for insurance will be able to afford getting the healthcare they need with all the deductibles. these are unknowns. But what's known is this. We needed something to be done so that people who were previously denied because of pre-existing conditions could somehow get health insurance. And that, at its most basic, right, is what this has done.
I love how Marco Rubio says it's disrupted this healthcare system marketplace. I mean, that was a pretty dysfunctional marketplace.
And that was the point, wasn't it, to
that
disrupt
it? That was the point.
Yeah, that was the point. Marcia is joining here, the Florida Roundup today from Lake Worth. Marcia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Tell us your story.
Thank you for taking my call. Well, I signed up under the Affordable Care Act. I had insurance before. We have a small business. We also have a son with a pre-existing condition, and we were paying the highest rates possible. We were paying $2,000 a month for health insurance. Now I'm paying $1,400 a month, and I don't have any deductible. My co-pays are very small. I'm very happy with the plan. Thank goodness the Affordable Care Act was passed.
Marcia, have you used the plan yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I started using it in January.
And let me ask about your network. I mean, all your previous doctors are still in the new network?
Or how does that work? Sure, I picked a plan that had all the doctors that we, you know, wanted to stay with. And I picked the best plan for us, and it's been terrific, and so much better than before. I'm so happy with it, and I'm so glad that this was passed.
Marcia,
and I don't understand why they want to. Why do they want the Republicans want their fellow Americans not to have affordable health insurance? I don't understand that,
Marcia. I think that a lot of Republicans in the audience would say we're not arguing that Americans shouldn't have affordable health insurance. The argument, Tristram, is that the marketplace for health insurance ought not to be dictated by a central government. In this case, the federal government.
Yeah. But you know, the problem with that is that this isn't we're not talking about widgets. We're not even talking about you know, cars or power lines. We're talking about health, and the healthcare market skews to the healthy, right? The insurers, everybody wants to insure the healthy people. Nobody wants to insure the sick. So it's not a true marketplace that can correct itself. It needs help from the government.
Well, obviously, when we had a situation where the insurance companies could cherry pick and just throw out people who had pre-existing conditions, who were the sick ones, who were going to be using more than they paid in, they got rid of them. And that's not a fair system either when you're talking about people's lives.
We're talking about signing up for the Affordable Care Act. The deadline to enroll passed this week. Mike Mayo from the Sun Sentinel is along with us. Tristram Corton from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup as we say hello to Carla in Pembroke Pines. Hi, Carla. What's your story?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I signed up for the Affordable Care Act about a month ago, and I haven't had health insurance actually for a couple years after leaving my last job and going back to school as a full-time student. And right now, under my current employer, I work as a part-time substitute teacher for Broward County. I'm not eligible for health insurance. So, I signed up about a month ago. I haven't used it yet, but I have received my insurance, my card.
So you've paid your premium. You've paid your monthly premium.
Well, actually, the good thing was because of my projected income for this year, I was actually eligible to get the tax credit, which, I mean, not everyone gets that, but I was able to use that to cover my entire premium for one of the lowest insurance plans that they had available.
So no out-of-pocket expense for you, Carla, Pembroke Pines,
none,
for the premium itself?
At all. And I'm very happy about that because it would have cost me somewhere, for me, for what I need. I'm single. I'm not married. I don't have any children. I would have ended up paying like $250 a month for like the cheapest plan.
Hey, Carla, you're not alone there in Pembroke Pines, Mike. 9 out of 10 Floridians who signed up through the end of February qualified for a subsidy.
Yeah, and that's good news. It's showing that this is working as intended. And when we're hearing these positive stories, you know, it's very heartening. And I guess that should hearten the Democrats as well, because obviously they've been taking a pounding and hearing a lot of the negatives, especially from, you know, she mentioned that she's a part-time substitute teacher and doesn't get offered health insurance as part of her employment package. And that's really, I guess, one of the big concerns I've heard of people who are kind of considered independent contractors, or they work for a company, and then the companies now, they don't want to have to pay, they don't want to have to provide the health insurance, so they cut the hours, and then so now these people are working, you know, technically less hours, but then they end up adding on, but they don't still don't qualify for getting the coverage through the employer.
You cut or cap the hours because of the 29-hour maximum under the Affordable Care Act. Let's go to line one. Janine joins us from the Redland. Welcome to the Florida Roundup, Janine.
Hi, I'm just calling because I have an aide that works for me. She's a health aide for my 96-year-old father. She was able to sign up, and she got a plan for, I think she said, $37 a month. She has a 23-year-old college student daughter who was working but was not making enough money. And they told her, and she tried repeatedly, and she says they told her that her daughter did not qualify, and she tried to do it online. She tried to do it in person. And I don't understand that, so I'll just let you guys tell me what you know about that. But she didn't make enough money, so she didn't qualify. But why didn't she qualify under her mother's plan?
Well, she ought to be qualified because she's under 26 years old, which is another significant change of the healthcare legislation, Tristan. But in terms of the income, there is the donut hole for those Floridians that don't make enough money to qualify for the tax subsidy allowed under the Affordable Care Act and healthcare.gov, but they make too much money to qualify for Medicaid in Florida due to Florida's inability to expand Medicaid and accept the $51 billion in expansion dollars that were offered by the federal government.
Well, I mean, are these people who would otherwise go without? I mean, now it's being made available to them. You can get healthcare. You may not qualify for a subsidy depending on your income. And you may not qualify for Medicaid.
You have to have a certain level. You have to have enough income to actually qualify for the subsidy. So if you make not enough money, you don't actually get financial assistance under the ACA and healthcare.gov. But if you make too much money, you don't qualify for the poverty-based, income-based Medicaid.
Too rich for Medicaid,
That's too
poor for the subsidy. And the problem was if the legislature had acted rationally and humanely, they would have expanded the Medicaid because, again, it was at no cost to Florida for the first few years and then revisit it when the cost went up later. They did not do that.
Governor Scott first rejected it, and then he did turn tail on it and was trying to get the state legislature to accept Medicaid.
And that's because uninsured people cost the state government money. And local governments.
Some argue to the tune of $7 to $10 million a day, according to one lawmaker, as a matter of fact.
The question is now, what happens to them? They still don't have the health care. They didn't sign up. So they're still going to be going to the emergency rooms when they have a health crisis. And I thought the whole point of this was to try to, you know, alleviate the burdens on the ERs and the overall costs, which ends up getting borne by all taxpayers because they still have this indigent care program set up where we cover it.
Julie joins the conversation from Miami on line two. Julie, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Tell your story.
I signed up very early through the healthcare.gov. I had no problems with the computer. I had no problems getting online. I had actually no problems getting my insurance. However, we have existing insurance, which expired March 1st, and I wanted my new insurance to start then. They started in February. So I was told to cancel my insurance and reapply, which I did. We're now in April, and the company is not even recognizing that I have insurance. I've paid my premium three times online.
Wait, you're saying you canceled the new healthcare.gov insurance?
Or your previous individual plan?
The healthcare.gov. I canceled it, and I reapplied through healthcare.gov.
Okay, because that seems like don't throw away the bird in the hand that's coming for the next year.
Right.
Try to you know, cancel the previous insurance, and then if they balk at giving you any kind of repayment, and then, I don't know, I guess you might be out of luck for that for that last month. But
that's what I was trying to do, and I was trying to get a refund for that payment. And for a while, they said that was no problem. Now I have some medical issues, and they were saying they sent me a card, they sent me an ID number, and they're saying, and plus the fact when I call, they say, well, that's a healthcare.gov issue, we can't help you. Healthcare.gov says to me, no, that's, you have to call your insurance company. So I get bounced back and forth.
Julie in Miami, this really highlights here, Mike, the among the challenges here of a central plan, in other words, the HHS plan regarding the Affordable Health Care Act and the healthcare.gov, being kind of articulated in the marketplace by private companies.
Right. I mean, what we still having, when people say socialized medicine, I'm amused because we still have private profit-driven insurance companies and private profit-driven hospital chains and doctor's offices. All it is just the government is saying, you've got to get this. And now, obviously, with her story, it's some growing pains and transition pains. And that always happens when you're switching from one to another, and then there's overlap and there's different dates. And, you know, it's unfortunate, and I guess it's just a natural byproduct of that. I hope that not many have to endure what she's enduring. And the worst part is when you do have a major health crisis arise in the middle of it. I have a friend in New York who was previously covered on another plan, signed up through healthcare.gov, and had a major skiing accident on January 2nd. And now he's had a problem because the new insurance didn't apparently kick in. They didn't get the thing. There's a whole bureaucratic hassle.
7.1 million people, the White House claims, signed up for healthcare under the Affordable Care Act before the deadline this past week. That's 7.1 million stories, certainly, to tell. Still to come on the Florida Roundup, hummingbirds, covert projects, and hopes of stirring political unrest in Cuba. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Zunzuneo, a hummingbird's tweet and the name of a cellular messaging social network engineered by the U.S. Agency for International Development, deployed in Cuba with the goal of stirring up political unrest. An Associated Press report published this week uncovered the project, publishing details of the effort. The White House said the program was not covert, but called it a discreet form of humanitarian assistance. Do you hear echoes of the Cold War in this project? How does it impact engagement with Cuba by using an aid organization instead of the CIA? Does it put other humanitarian efforts at risk? Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or on Twitter using the call sign at WLRN. Mike Mayo still with us from the Sun Sentinel, Tristram Corton from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, Tim Padgett covering the Americas for WLRN here with us as well, and Desmond Butler from the Associated Press, who covered this project for the AP, joining us via Skype from Istanbul, where he is working today. Desmond, let's begin. How did this technology work?
It was all based on text messaging, and the idea was that you could get people in Cuba to subscribe to lists and then text message them from the outside. Eventually, the idea was that they could also form groups and have followers and send out their own texts.
And who was it that was sending the texts? Was it spooks from the United States? Was it folks on the island?
I don't think they'd call themselves spooks, but they were contractors for USAID and subcontractors.
And this project stopped in 2012. It began about 2010 and stopped in 2012. Why?
We think there were two reasons. One, there were signs that the Cuban authorities were catching on to what was happening. People involved in the program who we spoke with suggested that there was various forms of harassment with their network. But aside from that, it appears that the funding for the program ran out and they didn't see a way that they could make money, they could generate revenues and keep it going.
So now, by generating revenues, you're not talking about this as a commercial enterprise, though, are you?
Well, they actually were pitching it as a potential commercial enterprise and trying to pass it on to someone who might have an interest in it.
Who is the they here? Is it USAID? USAID?
It is USAID, but it was really being channeled through their contractors. They actually talked to potential investors. They tried to recruit management for kind of shell companies they set up without telling the potential executives that they would be working on a U.S. government program.
One of those reportedly that was attempted to be recruited was Jack Dorsey, of course, one of the co-founders of Twitter.
That's right. And he, at least according to documents, held meetings with a State Department official and some of the contractors about taking over the project.
Desmond Butler from the Associated Press joining us via Skype from Istanbul. Desmond was among the authors of the report from the AP this week that disclosed this U.S. AID program that operated for 2 years in Cuba. A Cuban Twitter is what it's been nicknamed. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here on WLRN. Is this any different from other broadcasting efforts that have been underway for 50-plus years into the island?
Well, at least with organizations like Radio Marti, these are out in the open. The problem, I think, that has come crashing down on projects like Zunzuneo here is that, you know, we're using a humanitarian foreign aid agency, USAID, to essentially do spook work in Cuba. And I think this is not the first instance that we've seen of this. There's a 64-year-old U.S. aid contractor in prison right now in Cuba who was working for USAID. He's sitting in prison on very questionable espionage charges, but nonetheless, he was nabbed for spy work.
But this doesn't help his case at all.
No, not at all. And one of the damning parts of this AP report...
This is Alan Gross, by the way, right?
This is Alan Gross. And one of the damning parts of this AP report is that USAID decided to go ahead with Zunzuneo, even after Alan Gross had been arrested, as if his situation weren't precarious enough already.
Desmond, did you see any evidence that Gross was involved with Zunzuneo?
No, I did not. I don't believe he was.
And to Tim's point as well, this is not the first time that USAID has been involved with these kind of efforts. Why not the CIA as opposed to USAID?
Well, I guess you have to ask the government that question.
I suppose, but let's ask this forward, Desmond, to you and to Tim here. What are the implications as this has come out into the open in terms of other humanitarian efforts that are underway, not only from the United States, but from others into Cuba? Tim, go ahead.
I think what it underscores here is that we're still trying to use 20th century Cold War cloak and dagger efforts. Trying to jam that square peg into the round hole of 21st century Latin American politics. So this idea that we can, one of the interesting things about the AP report, which was excellently reported, by the way, one of the interesting aspects is that, you know, the Obama administration now is saying, well, this was just an effort to increase political dialogue on the island. Well, the AP report shows the documents are saying, no, that this was an effort to create things like smart mobs that would create a sort of insurrection style, Tahrir Square style, Cuba Spring uprisings. Mm-hmm. So the intent here was sort of, you know, geared toward regime overthrow in a way, and the fact that we're using a humanitarian foreign aid organization to do this, I think, sort of, you know, points up how ham-handed U.S. Cuba policy has gotten.
And Desmond, doesn't it go also to speak and question some other efforts that the United States and others would have been undertaking in other troubled Latin American hotspots, Venezuela included?
Absolutely. USAID considers this democracy promotion work one of their core missions, and they're doing it all over the world. I can't say that they're doing it in this way all over the world, but I've talked to a lot of people at USAID who are troubled by this because the rest of their extremely important work distributing aid in times of trouble is called into question when governments whose cooperation they need is asking what else they're doing.
Mike Mayo from the Sun Sentinel, go ahead.
Well, I just want to jump in because I think what this also shows is that, you know, we're still trying to influence regime change in Cuba from the outside. And really what we've seen in the last few years, it has to be organic. It has to come from within. And yeah, we've seen these new uprising social democracy movements using social media to inspire. But again, it's from within those countries, within Iran and within Egypt. And so from us to act, you know, as a foreign power to try to introduce this I think it's failed at the, it's doomed at the start.
Yeah, and I also think it points up a sort of a cluelessness with regards to Cuba. Democratization in Cuba right now, the fact is the Castro brothers are going to die in power. Democratization and efforts in Cuba have to be focused post-Castro. What are we going to be doing post-Castro to undermine communist totalitarianism there? You're not going to do it with sort of ham-handed projects like this. The sad part is that USAID, what it could be doing, are so many other genuinely effective things, like trying to get capital to this emerging group of entrepreneurs in Cuba that would do much more after the Castro brothers died to foment democracy in Cuba.
And we've seen very small movements, but movements nonetheless toward just that the Castro regime has actually taken in the last month or so.
There is a window halting, yeah, but it's still opening, and USAID should be taking advantage of it.
Desmond Butler with the Associated Press. Finally, I have to ask you, what's happened to the technology that was deployed for Sun Zuneo?
It's a good question whether or not it... whether or not they just pulled the plug. There is another service that was rolled out called Pyramideo, but I don't know if that's in any way related.
Desmond Butler, really great work with the Associated Press on Sun Zuneo, the Cuban Twitter, joining us via Skype from Istanbul. Tim Padgett, covering the Americas for WLRN. Always a pleasure, Tim. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you.
For 5 years, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement has worked on an automated system to identify fingerprints, but an investigation by the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting finds technical problems with the system have led to millions of dollars in additional spending and delays in police investigations throughout the state of Florida. Tristram Corton from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting led the effort. He is with us here on the Florida Roundup. Describe this fingerprinting system for us, Tristram.
Well, it's a database of fingerprints and a system of matchers software that takes an input of a fingerprint,
yep,
that you want to try and find, whether it's partial or whole, and compares it to this vast database of millions of fingerprints.
There's two parts of this. One is the criminal investigation. The other is employers just, yep, doing criminal background checks of,
exactly,
job applicants.
Exactly. And it's the same database, the same set of fingerprints that are being checked against. But
how does it work? You give a fingerprint.
Right.
And it goes through an automatic algorithm.
Right, exactly.
Looking for a database match.
Exactly.
That's the way it's supposed to work.
And then usually there's a human, certainly in a criminal case, there'll be a human analyst, right, to review it.
Does it work that way? Does it work as designed?
The FDLE says yes, and that it's very accurate. What they admitted in a funding proposal to the legislature in 2012 was that the system is crashing, that it's not working at optimum capacity, and that it's causing delays in investigations and processing of crime scenes around the state. So it doesn't sound good. I'll just continue on with this. They contracted Motorola to build this system,
right,
in 2007, and for $7.4 million, and it was completed in 2009. So what's emerged since then is that an engineer for Motorola had noticed that it was not meeting that internal tests were not meeting the accuracy requirements of the contract.
So it wasn't accurately matching enough,
right,
fingerprints like it ought,
right,
to be.
So it was. I think the contract language is 99.9% for a full fingerprint,
sure,
submitted.
And in considering a full fingerprint submitted, most times is going to be civil in nature. It's going,
right,
to be someone applying,
right,
for a job doing a regular background check,
yeah,
or a criminal check. You would want an extremely high level of accuracy for,
right,
this automated system.
And they can deliver that. But for various reasons, the tests kept coming back at up to 99%, 99.1, 99.2. And that's hundreds of fingerprints in a day. And the latent fingerprints and palm print tests were also coming back far below the contract requirements. So he complained about the company's procedures and how the software was being written and whatnot. And he was removed off the project and then eventually fired. Before he left, he downloaded all these tests and he has them. And he filed a whistleblower lawsuit.
Right. Claiming that the state of Florida was a victim of fraud in this case.
Was a victim of fraud, indeed.
Right.
Indeed. And surprisingly, the state of Florida said, we want nothing to do with your lawsuit. We do not stand by it. And in fact, the attorney general filed a motion to dismiss it. They say they've dismissed it. It's going to be heard by a judge, an appeals court judge.
The Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the subject, the user, the vendor in this case, had an investigator general, its office, look into it and said it found no problems with the contract. But what about with the database? What about with the actual technology?
So I don't know anything beyond the testing phase. So when it was handed over to the FDLE, I have not seen these test reports. The FDLE will tell you it's very accurate. They're having no problems.
In fact, we did ask the FDLE to participate in our discussion, Tristram, as you know, and they declined, but they did send us this statement, quote, we have already told Mr. Cordham that his speculations are inaccurate because he doesn't fully understand our system and how it operates. Further, he has made no effort to understand the system and continues to confuse the databases and how they relate to one another. Now, my comment here to you, Tristram, is the databases, plural, that they're referring to is the partial criminal database for fingerprints and the usually full fingerprint for civil employer investigations.
Correct, correct.
Gotcha. So the FDLE continues on with its statement here. Quote, the FDLE continually monitors accuracy rates. The number of unmatched fingerprints submitted to the FBI totals less than 1% of all submissions. A criminal 10 print is exceeding expectations, and we have been pleased with the system, end quote. Your response?
Well, that's what they're going to say in their lawsuit. I mean, they're really going to have to hash this out. It would be ideal for the public to hash this out in court, to allow this lawsuit to go forward. I know it's not, for whatever reason, it's not in
the FDLE's interest. Is there an independent authority?
Is
it, you're asking essentially a third party to step in and look at these look at the current accuracy reports since 2009. That's what you'd like.
So they're claiming that I've, you know, and it's a very confusing thing. I've talked to engineers. I've talked to the engineer filing the lawsuit and engineers outside of this to try and understand it as best I can. And they're claiming I'm conflating the two systems.
The criminal and the civil background check systems.
But when you look at their funding requests, they say, I will quote, that the systems are interlinked. They're using the same set of fingerprints to search, whether it's criminal or civil. And they are, the same matchers. So, and they're asking for, over the years, over these past 4 years, in their $11 million. They built the system for $7 million. They've asked for $11 million over the years to keep it running. That's a lot of money.
It's right. Well,
and their budget estimate for maintenance was like $280,000 a year.
That's the question that I wanted. The estimate to keep maintaining it was a fraction of what they've asked for to actually maintain it.
Exactly. So when they complain to me about the story and the lawsuit, they're not addressing any of this other stuff. Yeah. The other issue is, very quickly, that these reports, these Motorola reports, were apparently never shown to the FDLE. The FDLE says they weren't required to show them to us. That's at issue too, because the contract.
These are the reports.
One interpretation
based
is
upon the whistleblower lawsuit is based upon. Mike Mayo from the Sun Sentinel, go ahead.
My only comment is it sounds like Motorola might be in line to get Florida's next election contract,
or the unemployment database. They could do the unemployment.
Well, we've had problems with the unemployment database, and Motorola not involved with that, as far as we know. Tristram, where does this wind up? Does the Department of Justice get involved? The FBI get involved with this? I mean, we've seen other legal law enforcement agencies through the years have trouble with crime labs and fingerprinting technologies as well.
Right. I have no idea. I haven't even asked if the FBI would be involved. I think that the next development in this is going to be a judgment on whether or not Mr. Baratti's lawsuit can
proceed. Is the former Motorola engineer, the whistleblower behind this, right? In the meantime, have we been able to understand any impact that this system has had on criminal justice, on prosecutions in the state?
No, it's too far. It would be very rare for it to affect prosecutions. That said, in the past, it has happened. The FBI arrested a lawyer in Washington State and linked on a fingerprint ID and linked him to a bombing in Madrid, and they jailed him for 2 weeks or something, and it turned out it was error. It was both database error and human analyst error, and he sued and got a nice settlement from them. but it does happen. It's extremely rare. It's obviously everybody's worst nightmare. There was one incident during testing where they found a false positive, where the system linked two fingerprints that were not the same.
Would you be satisfied if the FDLE were to offer to make public its accuracy reports since using it in 2009?
I think that would be great. I think, yeah, if they want to reassure us that everything's fine and there's no problem with this system, come up with something other than a statement saying everything's fine.
Is that not public record, or?
That's a good question. Whether or not they still run internal accuracy rates. I mean, they're saying
it's accurate. Criminal 10-point, which is what they call this,
right,
exceeding expectations and have been pleased with the system. That's the statement provided to WLRN.
They've used some other figures in the past. They put out their inspector general put out a 4-page report, which is not very much when you're dealing with these complex technical issues. And they didn't cite anything other than interviews with engineers in the FDLE.
Tristram Corton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Mike Mayo with the Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Stay close. We got plenty more to come. Big crowds, big events, big bucks, and the trouble they bring. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Spring Break, 1961. Fort Lauderdale and Connie Francis. Spring Break 2014 sounds a lot different. Canadian electronic dance music DJ Deadmau5, Bayfront Park, Miami.
Where the boys are.
A half century separates the sounds of spring break in South Florida.
Where the boys are.
Big events drawing big crowds, thousands of people visiting, catching some sun, and partying. But while Fort Lauderdale's spring break business has matured, Miami's has mushroomed with the Ultra Music Festival. Rowdy behavior, par for the course, certainly, but when rowdy turns risky for public safety, what should be the response? Friday night, a week ago, as the 2014 Ultra Festival was beginning, 28-year-old Erica Back was working as a hired security guard near Bayfront Park. She was behind a temporary chain-link fence when a group of festival goers charged the fence, knocking it over, overwhelming security, and leaving her in critical condition with a fractured skull and a broken leg. The festival blames, quote, unruly gate crashers, end quote. Mac's family's attorney is expecting to file a lawsuit in the weeks and months ahead. Miami police say they warned festival organizers they needed to bolster that stretch of fence before the gate crashing. Did you go to Ultra? Did you hear the music? Should it return to Bayfront Park next year? The dates have already been selected. Share your story at 800-743-WLRN here on the Florida Roundup. That phone number, 800-743-9576. Send us a tweet at WLRN or go to WLRN.org. Mike Mayo with the Sun Sentinel, Tristram Corton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, Danny Rivero from Fusion, and Mark Hedden joining us from Key West. Danny, first let's begin here. These large festivals, Ultra has been around for several years. It is a known entity, certainly in Bayfront Park in Miami. Was this year's trouble any different from years past in your estimation?
I mean, the way that it differs is that, you know, there was a tragedy. There was a big accident. But in most other regards, it went pretty much as planned. And, you know, this is kind of firmly placed as a spring break tradition now. You know, it's been around since the late 90s. And this is the first time that an event like this has actually happened. You know, there has been concerns through the years about the security. People have jumped the gates in the past. But this is the first time that, you know, it actually manifested in, you know, real bodily harm.
For several years, though, we have had folks injuring themselves via drug intakes and drug overdoses. Is that an area of concern as that continues to grow? And these crowds swell to several hundred thousand.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a concern with any festival. You know, we have, you know, different festivals here in South Florida, like the Virginia Key Grassroots.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of consumption that goes on in those two. A lot of people that are treated by paramedics. This last ultra, there was 118 people treated for paramedics. A lot of those people suffered from heat stroke or, you know, the heat exhaustion. So we don't know exactly how much of it to attribute at this point to drug use while it is happening.
Mark Hedden joining us from Key West, a place that's certainly known for dealing with overindulgence on the part of visitors. The lessons that community can have in the Conch Republic for even Ultra and other places in South Florida that continue to see these festivals grow in popularity as well as economic impact.
Well, in Key West, the spring break seems to have fallen off a bit. We had a special spring break court set up, which opened on March 2nd, and they closed it on March 6th because nobody had
been getting in trouble at Key West. But perhaps that was is that the result of spring break dying off because of the spring break court?
I think they're going to other places, actually. Yeah. And part of it in Key West right now is we're down 400 hotel rooms. Because they're being renovated. A lot of the bigger chain hotels are that usually where the spring breakers stay. So maybe they couldn't get, you know, rooms they could afford.
Mike Mayo with the Sun Sentinel. It was years ago where Fort Lauderdale was the place to be. Talk about rowdy beach behavior in March. Fort Lauderdale was the poster child.
At one point the king of spring break, and then it moved up to Daytona Beach, and now it's migrated to different spots. It went to Texas and Cozumel. But the bottom line is this, you know, with what happened at Ultra last week, obviously a tragedy. Obviously there should be new procedures in place. But I think what we're seeing now is maybe this overreaction from officials who have been looking for an excuse to get rid of it.
Well, why is that, though? Why, you know, the Miami mayor, Tomas Regalado, the commissioner, Mark Sarnoff, whose district includes downtown, have talked about kicking Ultra out.
Because it's not the right, quote marks, you can't see my air quotes on radio, but it's not the right demographic, the right crowd. That's what happened in Fort Lauderdale, where eventually they cracked down on the spring breakers by just throwing everybody in jail.
Do you agree with that, Danny? Not the right crowd.
I mean, it depends on your age demographic, where you're coming from. I mean, I've grown up around this. You know, this has been happening since I was like 13. So, from my point of view, it's, you know, it's normal. It's a cultural institution in our city,
right?
And you know, to say you can't come here, you know, Ultra sprang out of Miami and now it takes place in South Korea.
And I'm not
Argentina.
Saying it's the wrong crowd. I'm just saying it's a misunderstood crowd. Mm-hmm. And it could be a very important crowd because they're going to grow up and one day might want to relocate and do business and raise families here, which is what happened with so many of the previous generation spring breakers from Fort Lauderdale, myself included. Now, just I want to say one more thing. We have all these.
Hold on. I can't let that go here. You visited South Florida in spring break and now have become part of South Florida.
It's one of those situation. I had an aunt and uncle that were in Boca. I came down here in college and stayed with them, but then ended up down on the strip in the Elbow Room and the Button and the candy store. And, you know, I liked it. And I said, wow, I could deal with this weather and this scenery. And I got a job down here in 1989.
Been paying taxes ever since.
So exactly right. That's absolutely right, Tristram. I mean, let the economic development crowd know.
Plant these little rowdy seeds and they can grow into some responsible adults.
It's a really powerful marketing tool for us as a region, period. You know, over this last weekend, I met people from, you know, the Netherlands, from France, from Atlanta, everywhere. People flock down here and
big international.
They want
draw.
To come back.
And I just want to say one thing. We have other tragedies at other big events. You know, lobster mini season every year, we have some unfortunate deaths. The Winterfest boat parade up in Fort Lauderdale, sometimes people get a little too tipsy and fall off bridges and drown in the intracoastal. Well, but we don't see anybody trying to ban those outright.
Yes. I mean, there's self-inflicted injury, all right, from overindulgence or heat stroke or not taking care of oneself. And then there are public safety concerns. A group of gate crashers, rowdy gate crashers, if you want to listen to the Ultra representatives, crashing through a gate. Stepping aside whether or not the festival itself did enough to bolster that area, but then fracturing the skull of a hired security guard and breaking the leg is something entirely different. But we have seen those kinds of public safety issues happen as well. The Cayocho Festival, a man shot, for instance, last year. That doesn't necessarily bring significant calls to kick the festival out of Cayocho, to move it along.
Yeah, I mean,
or to end it entirely.
I think what we're, like, Commissioner Sarnoff said that nothing's going to change until Ultra organizers acknowledge they need to find a new venue outside of the urban core. in my view, I don't see the causal relationship between being in the middle of the city and an event like that. I don't, I mean, it's a big stretch. You know, if you put it out in Homestead, the same exact thing could
happen. If I recall, there was a big festival in the late 60s out on a farm somewhere in upstate New York that had nothing at all to do with the urban core as well, and there was some rowdiness behavior there. All right, Richard joins us from Miami here on the Florida Roundup on line two. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I'm in favor of keeping Ultra here. It was unfortunate what happened, but I think, I'm sure they learned from it. You brought up the incident at Cayayocho where someone was shot, but no one's screaming for that. And that was local, and that was probably more closer to home for the mayor. This was 170,000 people. Over half of them are from out of town who come in, fill the hotels, fill the restaurants. They're downtown. You keep hearing the city officials whining and crying about, we can't get anybody to come downtown. Downtown is dead in the evening. You can fire a cannon down Flagler Street and not hit anybody, except during Ultra, you couldn't look down Flagler Street. It was so full of people, which was phenomenal. Businesses stayed open later. They had customers. It's unfortunate when you pack 170,000 extra people.
We had let the dogs out?
Excuse me?
Richard, we'll let you get back to your canine associate there that's talking to you in the background, certainly. But Richard's got an interesting point here, Danny, which is, you know, Cayocho is a festival for real natives here, whereas, you know, Ultra does have a huge and significant and growing outside South Florida population that it draws in.
Yeah, and it's
those people then don't vote if folks want to, you know, for instance, cancel the or push out the festival.
That's true, and it's also kind of come up at the same time that the condo boom has come up. So that now we have more residents than we've had in a very long time in downtown Miami, and you know, the shops are opening up. They're talking of expanding Flagler, making it more pedestrian centric, and to kick something like that out of the city and say, like, no, you can't do this, I think it would just be a blow to our image. Like, well, like I mentioned, Ultra takes place around the world.
Yeah.
If the place that it was founded says you can't do it here anymore, I mean, what message is that going to send internationally?
Tristram, go ahead.
So weren't politicians complaining that these people weren't spending their money here in town? I mean, wasn't that the complaint? They're too young and they're not spending the kind of money. So is that a dollar amount? We're willing to put up with some rowdiness or some violence if they're spending enough money and occupying the hotels? But I don't know. I mean, obviously these people need places to stay, so that they've got to be impacting the hotel rate. And they are literally coming from around the world.
I can tell you they're impacting the hotel rate. They're impacting the airfare rate as well. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It is a supply and demand market, Mayo. You know this. You knew it in 1989, and you know it here in 2014.
Yep. And look, you know, we're going to have complaints whenever there's large crowds, especially of youths that maybe don't conform to what the elders and the respected business people would like to see. And, you know, same thing happened with Urban Beach Weekend, Memorial Day Weekend. Yeah. And, you know, look, we have to be tolerant. And I think having Ultra downtown, it's a good thing, but it needs to be controlled. And it needs to be controlled with better foresight, planning, and policing so that we don't have a situation where there could be a mob crashing a gate.
Says the guy who lives in Fort Lauderdale.
Right, says the guy who lives in Fort Lauderdale. Right. I mean, what did Fort Lauderdale do to move away those rowdy spring breakers like the Mayos back in the late 80s?
They became wildly aggressive in terms of policing and throwing pretty much everybody, arresting and throwing everybody in jail for anything. And then the message comes out, you're not really welcome here. Go find some other place to have your spring break. And so everybody moved up the road to Daytona.
Mike, you did mention Urban Beach Week, and that's another certainly festival-like atmosphere, Danny, and you're familiar with that on the beach every Memorial Day weekend. There's been incidents of violence that we know that surround that. That is, I think it's fair to say, an event that is even less centralized than Ultra. It is much more part of the community in terms of going all over the place. But again, you know, we don't necessarily hear after every Urban Beach Week calls to cancel it or to move it as opposed to more heavily police it.
I would almost disagree with that, because a lot of residents are really not happy with Urban Beach Weekend. And, you know, I have my feelings on that. But, you know, In the last year that it happened last May, a lot of the heavy policing actually led to a lot of pushback from businesses because they said you barricade all the streets, you make the police presence so prevalent, people don't want to come here. You know, like I used to have a reason to go there because maybe I would just want to go to the beach.
Sure.
Now it's like, stay away from the beach, don't go there. And then the businesses are losing because of that.
Danny Rivero with Fusion. We've got Tristram Corton with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and Mike Mayo from the Sun Sentinel all along here on the Florida Roundup. Thank you to all of our guests and callers here today. We do want to remind you that April is National Poetry Month, and WLRN, along with the Old Miami Poetry Festival, are helping you discover your inner poet. We are inviting you to think of a special place between the Palm Beaches and the Keys. Maybe it's Urban Beach Week. Maybe it's Ultra. Maybe it's Spring Break 1989 with Mike Mayo along board in the beach of South Florida. Take a picture in your mind. Send us a real picture of it. Write a poem about it. Include the phrase, "This is where," and submit it to WLRN.org by 6 p.m. on April 21st. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup here today. We'll be back on the air with a rebroadcast 6 a.m. if you missed any of the program. It'll be posted later on today at WLRN.org. Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chin and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Executive producer is Peter J. Merritt. South Florida Arts Beat is next with Ed Bell. Monday morning at 9 a.m. on the Sunshine Economy, philanthropy, giving it away in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.